Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're talking about talking. Rhetoric, that is, and its role in politics. It's a timely topic. As the presidential campaign grows more intense, the candidates, along with hundreds of staffers and consultants, are busy working on turns of phrase they hope will persuade us to vote for them. Though we may not always be aware of it, they're using time-tested rhetorical devices. Donald Trump has a particular fondness for apophysis, a figure of speech used to bring up a taboo subject by pretending not to bring it up. Here he is talking about Hillary Clinton.
And I'm not going to say it because I'm not allowed to say it because I want to be politically correct. So I refuse to say that I cannot stand her screaming into the microphone all the time.
And here's Hillary Clinton using antithesis, where she arranges two different ideas in parallel to emphasize the contrast between them.
We will not build a wall. Instead, we will build an economy where everyone who wants a good job can get one.
The political discourse this election cycle has been memorable. Candidates have compared each other to terrorists, endorsed the word bimbo, and often, as CNN puts it, resorted to good old-fashioned name-calling. But has the discourse really been more divisive than in previous campaigns? What can we learn from studying how politicians historically have engaged the public? And how can studying rhetoric make us more informed voters? Two experts on the history of rhetoric are in studio with me today. Shirley Logan is a newly retired English professor from the University of Maryland, where she had a particular focus on 19th century African-American rhetoric. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
And Trevor Perry Giles is a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Maryland. He's written several books on political rhetoric, including one about Bill Clinton. Welcome to Midday.
Good to be here.
So let's start with the basics. What is political rhetoric?
That's a complicated question.
I have faith in you.
Okay. Presidential campaigns are for rhetoricians sort of like the Olympics, right? They're all about campaign or about communication, about rhetoric. Really, when you think about the relationship between campaigning and governing, much of what campaigns are about are persuading a group of people, the public, however you want to define them, supporters, even opponents, to do things, to vote for you, to give money, to volunteer, to oppose an opponent. And that's all about communication. It's all about rhetoric. And so political rhetoric, broadly defined, is this whirlwind of symbolic activity that seeks to get voters and the public and everybody else, in fact, the world community in a presidential campaign, to come around to see your particular vision of how the world should be and where we ought to be going in the future. And that's why it's so fascinating. And that's why I think Shirley and I have spent most of our lives studying this kind of rhetoric. It is so compelling.
Shirley Logan, what would you add to that description of rhetoric?
I think I wouldn't add very much, except the idea that now, in our current time, it's so much more accessible. So it's always been the definition that was given has always been the case. However, it's now with this 24-hour news cycle, where always you can turn on the TV or the radio or go to the internet anytime and get a piece of rhetoric, political rhetoric, because it's just bombarding us in every way. So to me, it's all about getting your word out, getting the message out. And it's always been that way, except now we have all these new ways of doing it.
You, a minute ago, Trevor Perry Giles, used the word symbolic. Mm-hmm. I think you said symbolic communication. Mm-hmm. So how much of what rhetoric is about is hidden as opposed to apparent in the words?
Oh, I'm not a big believer in that much is hidden. I think it's all pretty much out there, especially in a campaign. And like Shirley said, voters today have more access to more information, more rhetoric, more communication about presidential candidates, their policy positions than ever before in American history. And we always talk about the uneducated voter or the voter who, you know, the campaigns aren't giving them enough information or the media is failing. There is more information now than ever on everything. And I don't know that much is hidden.
Tell me what you meant by symbolic.
Well, I meant in terms of human beings are fundamentally symbol-using animals, to quote Kenneth Burke. Mm-hmm. He maintained that that is in many ways our essence as a species, that what sets us apart, and he wasn't alone in this, they've been saying this ever since ancient Greece, what sets us apart from other forms of life as we know them is our ability to utilize symbols in a way to express thought, to persuade others, to, exploit and maximize emotional impact. All of those things are what set us apart and what make us human in many ways. And so when we talk about symbol using, we're talking not about anything subliminal or hidden or anything, but the idea that the use of language, the use of visual imagery, the use of symbolism is what sets us apart as a species. And I think that's usually what those of us who study political rhetoric think about when we talk about symbol using.
Were you about to jump in?
Yeah, I was just thinking that actually nothing has really happened yet in this political season except what people say. It's all about words. It's all about language. It's all about how
There has been voting in the primary.
Well, there has been voting in the primary, but the promises that have been made haven't been kept. They've just been promises, right? Nothing has really happened. That's what I mean when I say nothing has really happened in terms of all of the consequences. The wall hasn't been built. So that's what I mean. It's only what you're saying, the symbolic, the meaning of what you're saying that suggests what people invoke different responses to.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does the rhetoric in this campaign strike you compared to campaigns of the past?
I have been thinking a lot about that, and I'm not sure that there's a great deal of difference in terms of, sometimes it does seem there's more vitriol than before, but I think, again, we're going back to accessibility, that every time something is said, we hear about it. I suspect that in previous campaigns, I haven't been around for all of them, but I do have a sense that... That's always been the case. It's just, again, now this immediate accessibility. And I guess I have to say maybe a little bit more of a willingness to go there, to say things that ordinarily you would kind of allude to. It seems that is, I guess I would step out and say perhaps in that, as far as that's concerned, we do have more explicit kind of name-calling and pejorative claims than we had before. And even that, though, I guess I'm not really a political historian, so I can't really say that that's actually the case, but it does seem that way sometimes.
Well, I think Shirley's right. The accessibility issue that we see every utterance of every candidate the moment it happens as breaking news on CNN or MSNBC it is a difference. I think that's an advancement. Even since 2008 or 2012, it didn't seem quite as ever present all of the time. The harshness, I guess, the anger that we see, the name calling, I think we've had instances of that in the past. Go ahead.
Tell me when.
Well, I'm particularly interested these days in the 1848 election. The Whig Party in 1848 nominated a little-known but kind of eccentric slave-owning, which was unusual for the Whig Party, general from the Mexican-American War named Zachary Taylor. And he said outrageous things, and he called his Democratic opponents names, and he was a gruff and kind of unkempt sort of candidate, in many ways the way Donald Trump is today. Now, the accessibility issue was different, obviously. People didn't have the ready access to everything he was saying. But the written record survives to us to this day. And he was kind of a scary dude. And, you know, he engaged in the name calling and the harshness and the like. So I'm interested.
And voters accepted it.
Yeah, he won. Yeah. He also, some historians credit his election and the subsequent aftermath with the demise of the Whig Party.
Ah, so it does have repercussions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum.
That is Trevor Perry Giles, a professor of communication at the University of Maryland, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me is recently retired Professor Shirley Logan. We're talking about political rhetoric. Do you think there is a difference in the way candidates talk this election cycle compared to the past? What has struck you about rhetoric in this political cycle? Join our conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Shirley Logan, why is it important to the political process that voters understand rhetoric?
Well, I think it makes them a lot more savvy about what's being said. I don't think we're always immersed in rhetoric. That's what it is. Language is persuasive language is rhetorical. But I think to the extent that we can arm people with the skills to hear and to notice how language is being, and I don't use manipulated in a pejorative sense, how language is being used to persuade, is helpful in trying to kind of tease out what people are saying and how they're enforcing their beliefs through the way that they present it. So we have the expressions that are repeated, and if they're repeated over and over, then you finally find yourself believing them, or you almost completing the statement enthymematically, you know, crooked Hillary. After a while, you begin to finish that yourself, and that kind of becomes ingrained. Or if we say that Trump is unfit to be president, if Clinton says that enough, then that becomes kind of part of, when you hear his name, that becomes part of what you believe. Now, so to the extent that you're aware of that, it's helpful, I think, to kind of be able to know how that's having an effect on you.
So tell me more about what we need to be aware of and how we get to be aware of it. I mentioned too the names, the Greek names of two figures of speech, one of which you could tell by how awkward I was in pronouncing it, I was not familiar with. Is it important to be aware of how these techniques have been labeled through the ages? Mm-hmm. Is that helpful to in being an informed voter? Are the candidates aware, do you think, that they are using a particular figure of speech when they do it?
That's a good question. I don't think they necessarily are. I study 19th century African-American women's rhetoric, and many of them did not have any formal education, certainly not in rhetoric, but if they did, they got it from listening to stump speeches and so on. So I think it's almost ingrained that we have a way of communicating because we hear other people communicating a certain way. And so we don't necessarily have to know the names of them, although in my rhetoric courses, the students would have to take Douglass's 4th of July speech and apply, look for all the paralepsis. But for example, epithet, what we were talking about with the name calling, the attaching the swift-footed Achilles, I think, in Homer used in the BC, you know, during that time, we still we use those things, and I don't know that you necessarily have to know the names, but it would be helpful to be aware of how they're having an impact on you, whether you can give the Latin or Greek name or not, but just to kind of be a little bit more aware of how you are being persuaded by the way that the language is being presented.
We have to take a quick break here, but before we do that, let me ask either one of you, does it in a sense remove some of the power of using a rhetorical device if I, as the hearer, recognize, oh, she's doing such and such, she's doing tapenosis, or she's doing, does that somehow disempower it?
Absolutely. That's the whole idea behind creating a sort of literacy on the part of the voter, right? It allows them to understand the bases upon which they are asked to reach a political judgment on election day. And that's ultimately what this is about, right? These candidates are asking these voters to reach a political judgment. And that judgment is not uncomplicated. It has far-reaching consequences for the identity of the voter, for how we see ourselves as a nation, for the policies that we're going to pursue over the next 4 years. I mean, these are not incidental things. And so if they understand the appeals, the nature of those appeals, and how those appeals are working on their capacity to reach that judgment, yeah, they're absolutely a more informed voter, I believe.
As I said, we need to take a quick break. Lots of people want to be part of this conversation, and you can too. Has a particular thing you've heard, a particular turn of phrase, changed your mind as a voter? Have you noticed it during this election season? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about political rhetoric and how the current campaign for president compares to those of the past. My guests are two professors from the University of Maryland, Shirley Logan, just retired from the English department, and Trevor Perry Giles from the Department of Communication. And we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780. Your emails at midday@wypr.org. Is what we're doing now around this table rhetoric?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, yes.
Because I am not aware that I'm trying to persuade anyone, except to call in.
Well, that's rhetoric.
That's rhetoric.
That's rhetoric, yes.
Okay, so yeah. So pretty much all talk is rhetoric.
Well, I always define it a little bit more narrowly when I talk to my students. Because I don't believe all talk is rhetoric. I don't believe all communication is rhetorical. For me, rhetoric has to involve some degree of public persuasion. It has to have an out. So you and I having a conversation over coffee is, in my mind, not rhetorical. Now, people are going to disagree with me on that, but I don't think you and I in an interpersonal encounter are engaged in a sort of public discourse, if you will. So that to me is the important difference. But that would classify our conversation here as rhetorical.
We're on the radio.
Clearly,
yes, that's public.
That's right. We have a public facing.
Let's talk to Ivan, who has phoned us from Annapolis. Ivan, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed hearing the talk so far. I had one comment as I was sitting here during lunch, and that was, you know, you talk about an informed electorate. I have a concern that's not about necessarily the informed electorate, but it's about the critical thinking skills of the electorate. And it's akin to saying that 2 + 2 = 5. We know that's not the case, but we can make the case. And without thinking about it critically, and that's very easy to do with something so simplistic, we would say, no, that's not the case. But I don't think our public, with all the information it's given, is necessarily engaging in that. I think they're engaged in what we might consider confirmational bias. That is, they sort the data in such a way that the stories, whatever they're hearing, the information in such a way that they're simply reinforcing their current beliefs as opposed to questioning it. And I think that's what we've seen in the primaries, and that's what we're seeing, and people are kind of standing up and not really stopping and saying what's what. And the last point I'll make is this. Many of the comments made during the elections are of what the candidate will do when they're in office, when in actuality, the office itself doesn't allow them to do those things. And that's why I've said what I've said. Thank you for your time.
Ivan, I appreciate the thoughts that you've put on the table. I'm turning to my professors to see how you'd like to respond to Ivan.
Well, I love Ivan's last point, because that's been a concern of mine throughout this entire election, which is this notion that the danger of the rhetoric from some of the candidates, and I would classify Donald Trump particularly in this regard, but I think Bernie Sanders kind of trafficked in some of this as well. It was a somewhat cynical misreading of the role of the presidency in American life and in the constitutional scheme that survives to this day, which is, I will give you free college. I will build a wall. I will do all of these things. Well, Ivan's right. the president in most frameworks and on most matters is unable to do things unilaterally. And I don't like that dimension to the rhetoric that came out of the primary campaign in particular.
Is it not implied, I will fight for building the wall. I will fight for free college.
That's different, right? They don't say that. They say, I will create. We will together do this. I will do these things. And it's almost a monarchical view of the presidency that really is a disservice, I think, to the voter.
Shirley Hogan, Ivan, our caller, said he worries that voters aren't capable of analyzing what they're hearing, that they receive it according to what they already believe. And
right.
When I heard him say that, I thought, well, okay, yeah. Voters are applying their values.
Exactly.
Is that not what
yes.
we expect
yes.
voters
I,
to
and
do?
And I was thinking about that. He clearly defined the notion of the most effective rhetoric is rhetoric, Perlman, rhetorician of the mid-20th century, talked about the challenge is to move people a little bit closer to what they already believe. It's adherence. You're trying to appeal to what they already believe, and when they hear the speaker say something that reinforces that, then they nod. You rarely do you start with a person over here and you X and get them over here to Y. It's all about tapping into what they already feel and maybe moving them along a little bit closer to adherence, mm-hmm. is what Perlman would call it. So, yeah, I mean, that's I think the secret of the campaigns, the success of some of the candidates has been this ability to recognize what people already feel and to tap into that and say, oh, okay, yeah, I like that. That's what I've been thinking anyway.
Can you give me an example from each camp? Either one of you.
Unfortunately, all of mine seem to come from one side, but I guess this idea of people being angry, this idea of people being the recent push to by Trump to attract African American voters, and the idea that why don't you join me? What have you got to lose? You get shot every day. You live in poverty. That's tapping into beliefs that his audience already has about African Americans, and so that's his audience, really. And that's another thing we right. should probably talk about his audience. It's that he realizes that that's a perception of his audience, and so he's tapping into that, and they're nodding. Yeah, what have you got to lose? You're not making any progress right. anyway. So he already knows what they believe, and he's moving them along even to reinforce those beliefs by what he's saying. So I don't think people really start out as a blank slate. As you say, they bring their values. They come with what they already believe. We all have opinions and beliefs about things. I don't know to what extent we can say that people are less critical. But I think we always bring our biases with us when we hear read something.
But Ivan's larger point too was that those biases and that confirmation bias are in ways, I'm not certain they're unique to this campaign, but they
yeah.
are then still there, motivating people to ignore what we would call the facts, right? So there is a sense that, many things that are uttered are not factual. And the media will come out and say they're not factual. They will show video of the candidate saying something directly opposing what they have now just recently said. And yet the audience member, because of those biases, will ignore this factual evidence. And I think Ivan's point is well taken. That's what, as rhetorical scholars and teachers, we try to do. Let the student understand how those biases might lead them in ways to ignore what is actually happening in the political world.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with two experts in the history of rhetoric, Trevor Perry Giles and Shirley Logan from the University of Maryland. Join our conversation. Are you a student of rhetoric? Have you come across any logical fallacies during this presidential campaign? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We may have covered this, but we haven't used the word, so I'm going to read Susan's email. Can the professors discuss propaganda as it relates to political rhetoric? Where's the line? propaganda? You're both looking at me.
Well, I always think of propaganda as sort of institutionalized rhetoric. So, you know, if you look at the history of propaganda, it began as a term in the Middle Ages, I guess, as something coming from the Roman Catholic Church. It was designed, the etymology of the term is rooted there, and it was the church's attempts to persuade, to proselytize, to...
to tell you what you must believe.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it then became a sort of governmental term when applied and exploited by governments, usually in wartime, to sort of create a sort of a national sense of purpose. So, you know, you can go back to the Creole days around World War I and the Wilson administration's attempt to persuade Americans of the war effort. But the key to propaganda, I think, is that it comes from a governmental or organized or powerful institution. So it's not just, you know, if it's synonymous with rhetoric, it's the same thing, right?
So are you saying that a candidate who has not yet been elected by definition is not speaking from that power base?
I don't know that I would say that it's institutionalized rhetoric in the same way that we would normally define propaganda as coming from an institution. Again, this is a definition that many of my colleagues, including some in my own department, might disagree with. But it's a useful distinction, I think, for understanding the differences between everyday political rhetoric and a more narrow sense of what propaganda represents.
Shirley, Logan, anything you'd like to say about propaganda, or should we move on?
No, let's
talk to Derek, who's called us from Pasadena. Derek, welcome to the show.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay, I want to call this out because I think it needs to be addressed. And here's my rhetorical plug, Sheila Cast. I hope you do a show on this. I think that Donald Trump has really tapped into the rhetoric that police departments around the country often issue, which basically boils down to don't hold us accountable, just trust us because we know what's best. And that even applies to a story that was reported today. The Baltimore City Police Department is flying surveillance over the city and didn't tell the public about it. And their response was basically, it wasn't a secret because we didn't tell you. It was just a secret because you didn't know about it. So I think that a lot of law enforcement entities, particularly police departments, have bought into this law and order Trumpism where we just don't dig deeper than what we're doing. Just trust that we're fighting the bad guys and we're winning.
Hmm. Derek, I appreciate your raising that point. So Derek is saying there's a rhetorical point about, he used a non-political example, an example in the news today of the Baltimore Police Department, which says it's evaluating a surveillance program and weren't trying to keep it secret, but they had not publicized it. Is that rhetoric, and is it especially evident today in a way that it wouldn't have been in previous campaigns, in previous decades?
Well, I think rhetoric is the use, is simply, if I can reclaim rhetoric's good name, it's just the use of language to persuade. Now, if you're using language to persuade, and the question becomes, is what you're trying to argue, is it valid, is it true? That's another matter. But rhetoric itself is kind of unavoidable. Mm-hmm.
Derek was particularly, zero in on this, because Derek was particularly critical of what he called the just trust us element.
Right, that's
but
true.
But is that not inherent in trying to persuade someone that a speaker of rhetoric will be trying to tell the listener, you should trust what I'm saying on this and you should go with me there. Mm-hmm. Is that inherent in rhetoric? Just trust us.
I think rhetoric has an obligation. Good rhetoric also can provide examples to support the claims. So it's not just trust me, because rhetoric has logical appeals, right? We can appeal to the logic or the reasoning skills of the listener. We can appeal to the personality.
Right.
Or to the emotion. So, but I agree with what he's saying about the question. You have to question what it is you're being asked to believe.
The just trust us is echoes, I think, the ancient rhetorical construct of ethos, right? Which is the extent to which a speaker or orator demonstrates, not just asserts, but demonstrates with what Shirley's talking about, evidence that they are, in fact, trustworthy. Right. What I hear Derek saying is the Baltimore Police Department's not doing that. Right. Mm-hmm. They're not saying trust us for these reasons. They're just mm-hmm. saying trust us
mm-hmm. because we're the police.
And right. Derek's absolutely right. That is very consistent with a sort of law and order rhetoric that we find in political campaigns. Trust me, I will bring back order to this country. Richard Nixon trafficked in this back in 1968, mm-hmm. like nobody's business. It's a common staple of political rhetoric. And what Derek is suggesting, I think, rightly so, is that we can't trust you based on your assertion. We have to trust you because you give us evidence of your right. trustworthiness. And that's the ancient Aristotelian concept of ethos.
Well, it's not uncommon for politicians to say persuasive things based on shaky logic.
Sure.
Trevor Perry Giles, have you noticed particular logical fallacies in this season's campaigning?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of logical fallacies because I think that's how we reason. That's how we talk. That is the nature of rhetoric.
Let me make sure I'm following. You're saying you're not a big fan of labeling something a
right,
logical
right.
fallacy.
I don't think that gets us anywhere. It begins the process of exposing why it is argument doesn't work as well as it does. I am much more concerned, though, with instead of identifying a logical fallacy, questioning the nature of the evidence that is provided. It's the difference between logical argument and what in rhetoric we call Toulminian argument, right? It's based in the theories of a guy named Stephen Toulmin, a philosopher of argument, who came up with an alternative to how to recognize good argument in actual rhetoric rather than in a sort of abstract philosophical sense highlighting the failures of rhetoric to achieve a logical ideal. That's basically it. And what I think the Toulmin model suggests is that we need to understand what evidence is or is not being provided to justify an argumentative claim. What warrants exist? Why are we being asked to believe these claims and these this evidence? And how do they link together? How do they work together? What are the wiggle spaces, what Toulmin calls the qualifiers, right? What are the probabilities or the except in these instances that might mitigate a particular argumentative claim? I think that's a more useful way of approaching political literacy, if you will, than searching out the logical fallacies.
We need to take another quick break. Shirley Logan, before we do, though, I want to ask you whether, going back to what you said a few minutes ago about values, voters in particular, people who care enough to be engaged in the process, bringing values to this, are they looking to do that kind of test of the evidence, or do they want to trust and sort of skip over the evidence?
Oh, okay. I think it's a combination. I think you most of the time, I bring my biases to the table, and then if what I'm hearing fits in with them, then I will pretty much follow the arguments that the speaker's making. That's me. That's just the way. And I think many people start off with what they already believe, and then they kind of try to see to what extent they can accept the arguments with which they're being presented.
Okay, yeah. As I said, we're going to take another quick break here. When we come back, more on the way politicians talk to us and what they are really saying when they do. Can you think of someone in politics who is particularly skilled in the art of rhetoric, who influences you by the way he or she speaks? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about rhetoric and how it shapes politics in this country. I'm speaking with Shirley Logan, and Trevor Perry Giles, two experts in rhetoric from the University of Maryland. And you can join this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Zach has called us from Reisterstown with, I think, an idea that was also kind of in the back of my mind. Zach, welcome to the show.
Hi. Long-time listening, first-time caller. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay. So my question is rhetoric, is the expectation of what we're looking at, because the last couple of examples that were given, kind of we were focused on one candidate. Is it fair to have the expectation that rhetoric, quote-unquote, can only exist on one side of the spectrum, oftentimes the opposite? Isn't this a job interview, right, for the most important job in this country? And what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and, if you're interviewing somebody for a job, what would you expect them to say about themselves?
Zach, I appreciate the question. You want to respond to Zach?
Yeah, Shirley and I were talking before coming on today about how Donald Trump sort of sucks all of the oxygen out of the campaign and out of the room. In other words, he draws our attention to him and, has people who try and analyze and discuss and process all of this rhetoric and talk about it with our students and on in forums like this, I'm always at least sensitive to the idea that it is important to be balanced, right? It is important to come up with other examples. That's why I mentioned earlier Bernie Sanders. I think they're all engaging in a rhetorical exercise. As I indicated, I think campaigns are, by definition, all about rhetoric. But the problem for this campaign, at least, is that Trump is so dominant. I mean, he just, like I say, he sucks all the oxygen out. He just draws everybody's attention to him. It is, in a way, somewhat unique in contemporary mediated campaigns to have that kind of focus. And that's why I think Zach's right. A lot of the examples tend to highlight it. It's not the reflection, though, that Hillary Clinton's not using rhetoric and somehow Donald Trump is. Mm-hmm. It's just the difference in the types of rhetoric they engage in is so stark, and that Trump's is so, I guess, remarkable. And I mean that in the sense that it is worthy of remark.
But
we're focused on it.
A few minutes ago, we talked about comparisons in history, and right. You said, right. There have been flamboyant candidates before. So when you say Donald Trump is so remarkable, are you saying he actually is, unique is not a comparative adjective, so I won't use that one, but that he is something we haven't seen in politics before in his use of rhetoric, and Hillary Clinton is much more in the middle of the road? I'm not saying in terms of her positions, but her use of rhetoric?
Mm-hmm. I would say that.
That's interesting. It may be that Trump is the better rhetorician in a way in terms of being able to attract, to get the soundbite, to attract the attention. I think with Hillary Clinton is using a more traditional kind of rhetoric, and so we don't remark on it as much as we should, but she's definitely using it. Everybody's using it. They're both rhetorical, and so when she says, I think it's clear from her campaign that she's saying that idea that Donald Trump is unfit. You hear that coming from everybody who's a surrogate or anybody from her campaign. So that's the message that they're putting out there. That's rhetorical. That's an intentional decision to repeat that enough so that people begin to think, I don't know whether I want this person to be the president. So that's a good question that he's asking about. We tend to remark more on his, and maybe it's because it's the less traditional kind of rhetoric that we're accustomed to hearing in campaigns.
But that in itself is interesting to me because, one could have looked ahead to this campaign and say, if Hillary Clinton gets a nomination, she will be the first female with a major party nomination, that will probably that will have a big impact on the rhetoric. And yet you say she's not having much impact on the rhetoric. The Washington Post ran a story this week headlined, Hillary Clinton talks more like a man than she used to. And they used some measures of language where she, since she was first lady, is using pronouns and other uses of speech that are more typical of male candidates. So she perhaps isn't changing the rhetoric much. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, that's a contested point about the whole question of masculine and feminine. What's masculine and what's feminine in terms of how people speak? I don't know to what extent that's a perception of the writer who wrote the article, as opposed to being an intentional shift on the part of the candidate to say that one is more masculine. I mean, the whole we can question that. In fact, what makes for masculine rhetoric?
That's a whole
that's a whole other conversation.
I'm reluctant, though, to accept the view that it can be boiled down to simply pronoun use. I think masculine versus feminine styles of rhetoric have a long history, and there have been careful analyses of feminine styles of rhetoric and the ways in which they have developed since easily the early 19th century in the American context. So, you know, it's nervous. It makes me nervous when we reduce it to pronoun use.
We'll post on the Midday webpage, we'll post a link to that Washington Post article. But cool. Right now I want to talk to Sophia, who's calling us from Baltimore. Sophia, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I'm Sophia from Baltimore. My comment is about the use of rhetoric and coded language. I know that when people hear different people who hear the same message can leave with different interpretations. And when Barack Obama was running, there was a lot of talk in the black community about this coded language that was being used. Now with Donald Trump, the language isn't coded. So when he says, make America great again, as a black person, I wonder, well, what makes America not so great? He then, you know, goes on to talk about the immigrants and, you know, the African-American community not having anything to lose because of all these statistics that I've never heard about, you know, that are negative. And so it makes me say as a black person, oh, is this why America isn't great again, based on all these things that he's saying? So rhetoric is very important, and it's interpreted based on who is listening to it and how it affects them.
Sophia, I appreciate your making that point. We talked earlier about coded language. Sophia says she doesn't think it's coded, but the example she gave struck me as somewhat coded.
Yeah, it's kind of depends on the hearer. For her, perhaps it's not coded. She knows exactly what the speaker means. But for others, it's kind of like the dog whistle.
Dog whistle metaphor.
Well, I mean, certainly there was a big example. And again, apologies, this is a Trump example, but his reference to the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. Second Amendment people, whoever they are, might be able to affect whether or not Hillary Clinton takes power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that coded language?
Sure.
Is there a name for that as a figure of speech? How does that fit into what we're talking about with rhetoric?
Well, it...
it has to do with the hearer. I think that, mm-hmm. that what she hears, what certain people hear, they comes from, I think, often a long history. A very long history, and what you've been hearing over time, and how you interpret that, and you just know, and that's not a very scholarly response. But there's a way in which you have become accustomed to hearing certain expressions and certain terms long enough that you know what they mean, mm-hmm. and I think that. Coded language may not even be coded. It just might be you hear different mm-hmm. people hear things according to what experiences they bring.
Andrea in Ellicott City wrote us, back when I was studying rhetoric and teaching English, my students and I enjoyed looking at then-Senator Obama's speeches for their many effective rhetorical techniques. But a lot of those rolling musical cadences seem to fall by the wayside over the years, and I was wondering if today's guests might have a guess as to why. Before I let you respond to Andrea's question, let's talk to Mo in Upper Marlboro. Mo, welcome to the show. We have just a little time left.
Thank you very much. I do feel that both individuals are very skilled in their rhetoric. I think that Donald Trump, in my opinion, uses it slightly differently and makes it more of a valid issue for him. And the reason I say that is that he uses simplicity of the issue to try and connect with the that is
his rally.
We're losing part of your point. Your cell phone is not serving you well. Can you just summarize what you most want the professors to address?
I think that both of them, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do use rhetoric. They use it differently. I think that, in my opinion, Hillary just isn't as skilled as at breaking down the individual issues so that she can connect with the individuals. Whereas
okay,
Donald Trump, that's just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Mo, thank you. You want to respond to Mo?
I think it depends upon audience. We're back to audience now about whether Trump or Hillary, which one is a... Well, see, I did it. I called Trump and Hillary. I should have said Clinton and Trump, I guess. Who is a more effective rhetorician? It has to do with audience, I think, and how Clinton might be reaching as many people as Trump. But the fact is that we are expecting a different kind of rhetoric, I think, from Hillary because we know the audience she's trying to reach as opposed to
so we
Donald.
Have different expectations.
Yeah.
And back to Andrea's point that she seems to be implying that mm-hmm. President Obama is not as effective a rhetorician as he
used to be.
I don't know whether either of you share that view.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought the president's speech at the Democratic National Convention was awfully good. The difference, of course, is that in a speech at the DNC, for example, he's out there promoting Hillary Clinton. When he's doing that, it seems more basely political. When you're talking about race or you're offering a eulogy for, shooting victims or you're doing any of those sorts of things, the rhetorical context is so different, the topic is so different that it allows for that sort of loftiness. And, President Obama really does rise to those occasions very well. I think you can find evidence that these other candidates do as well. Certainly, I know there was a much uncovered speech by Hillary Clinton following a shooting at an AME church in Philadelphia, I believe. Nobody ever covered it, but it's actually very lyrical and almost liturgical in its rhetoric. So,
we have just a half minute.
Sorry.
you two are going to be speaking about this very topic on October 10th at the university. Can you give me a sentence or two about what you're going to tell us then that we haven't covered today?
I think that the idea that the past is prologue, which is the kind of the title we came up with,
right.
And the idea maybe to help people understand the extent to which this is an ongoing.
Not a lot new under the sun.
Yeah.
I want to thank you both. Trevor Perry Giles, professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Maryland. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Shirley Logan, newly retired English professor from the University of Maryland. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market, locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads, specials each day. Eddie's of Roland Park. Park.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Older LGBT adults face a higher risk of social isolation as they age and experience disparate health outcomes. We discuss the unique needs of LGBT older adults and hear their stories. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.